Now, the question was, what are some examples of enduring value?
Right, and I put before the word enduring values more or less enduring values. I want to recognize that there are many different kinds of values. And I want to be able to say that a person who is working in a car wash could look upon their task of cleaning cars as a case of creating a somewhat enduring value. And they should be able, as co-working with God in a car wash, to regard this task as something to be done for the glory of God because of the goodness of what they produce. And their satisfaction should largely come from the realization of having done a good job producing that rather ephemeral value. But nevertheless, it's something that I want to say falls within the within the range of a value which endures. It doesn't endure long, maybe it rains, so you have a rain check or something for your car. But it lasts a while, and it is a good thing. Now, that's very marginal. The lady working at the Taco Bell, all right, she's going to produce good tacos. And the value there is not as enduring as some other things, you see. See, I'm very concerned about it, Larry, to talk about those kinds of things to begin with, because I don't want us to think that that there are just a few of these very exalted kinds of values that we would go for. Now, the person who is an engineer in the highway system, a policeman, a teacher. These are all cases of people who produce enduring values of safe and convenient transportation, of peace and righteousness, harmony, supposedly in a community, at least that is what they should be producing, or of knowledge, and of perhaps of encouraging people to become a certain kind of person. The teacher would do that. So you have a wide range of values. The artist who creates a thing of beauty, the architect, the filmmaker, all of these fall in the range of things of value. Now, we need to have a teaching on the part of the ministry which is not limited to the church house, but helps people see this world as belonging to God, and each one having their part in this world. And that's the responsibility of the teacher of religion. It should be the responsibility of all teachers. But one of the sad and distressing things about teaching in our society is it is regarded as a very low quality profession. Why do people not want to go into teaching? Well, it's because the intention of the teacher has been so cut down in so many ways. The teacher, there's that silly song that they had back in the 60s or sometimes, you know, off in the morning, off to school, the teacher's teaching the golden rule. I don't know if you remember that song, but the teacher doesn't teach the golden rule anymore. And the teacher does not stand as a representative of good values and as someone who is framing others in that same way. Our society has become very troubled about values generally, so that a lot of confusion in people's mind about this question arises from the general relativism and subjectivism of values, which says, well, you know, whatever you like is good. So a primary duty of the church is to stand and distinguish good from evil. Isaiah pronounces a curse upon those who call good evil and evil good. And there are plenty of people who are under that curse today. And the church needs to straighten that out.
I'm interested that you answered that in relationship to job, though, when you made the distinction between job and work, and our work is much bigger than our job.
Indeed.
So could you answer how to, examples of enduring values that are not connected directly to taco?
Sure.
What about kids?
Children are among the first things you would mention. Enduring relationships, friendships, convenient and a convenient, well-planned place to live is very important. Financial security in the limits that that's properly understood under God. Learning, knowledge, those are things we should work for. Health is worth working for. That's a value. We need to plan for the stages and seasons of life that we're going to go through. We need to be thinking about those together and with our mates. I want to talk more about that this afternoon, but we need to be thinking with our wives and those others that we go through the world with about how things are going to be later and planning for that. I mean, that's all very important. So, I mean, truth, goodness, and beauty. See, we need to take that very seriously and think about how we're going to contribute to that. And we need a lot of teaching there, too. Gary.
When you mentioned enduring value, when you mentioned enduring value, the statement of Christ comes to mind, where he says, do not lay up for yourself treasures on earth, but treasures in heaven. Mm-hmm. Some of the examples that you gave, like an engineer creating a bridge, say, functional, seem to be one of those things that moth and rust can destroy, and that is serving specifically the society that we're living in. And we tend to make a distinction between something like that, something of a treasure that is itself. Is that distinction proper? Is there a real distinction between that and why is Christ the
distinction to be drawn in that passage, Gary, in my opinion, does not have to do with the nature of the treasure, but with how you're approaching it. I wouldn't want to see someone treasuring a bridge, nor would I want to see them treasuring good tacos. I would like to see them treasuring the good that the bridge does and that the taco brings for other people. Ultimately, the only way we can lay up treasures in heaven is by the good we do to ourselves and other people. That's how we lay up treasures in heaven. The investments in money and time and energy to do good for people. So the good that is done for people is laid up in heaven. That's the treasure. It remains. It's forever. And so the bridge then is related to that. But a person, for example, you ever see the bridge over the River Kwai? I mean, there's a great story, isn't it? And when this guy realizes this bridge is about to be blown up, you know, it's hard to take. Well, you can see if you were attached to the bridge, you wouldn't want to see it blown up. You'd put all that work into it. But the object here isn't the bridge, and it isn't the taco. It's the enjoyment and benefit that people derive from it. In other words, it is when we do this as a service. It is living as a servant in these matters that allows us to lay up treasures where moth does not corrupt and moth and rust does not corrupt.
So in the same way, then, you would say that our job relates to our work.
We must be able in faith to put our job into our work. That's exactly right. And we can do that. If we see it right, and if the job is something that is intrinsically one that can't be fitted into our work in this sense, then we should change jobs. But nearly every job can be fitted into that. I would have some problem giving my energies to the liquor trade, for example. I don't have anything against alcohol as such, but if I were just, my whole life consisted in merchandising Old Crow, I would have a hard time with that. I mean, there aren't enough people that get bitten by rattlesnakes to warrant that. So, no, I mean, and I can also think of some time, I think there are some businesses which are relatively useless, but meet a demand of some kind. And I would have trouble with some of those.
Well, my job, I don't look at my people, but suppose I meet somebody that looks at their job like that.
Well, then you...
How do we get a person to think that their job is intrinsically related to their work in such a way that they know about it in a joyful way?
Well, in some cases you can't. And in other cases, I mean, you have to start with people, if you're going to deal with that seriously, you have to start where we started last night. You have to start by saying, look, you know, there is a thing called heaven and then there's earth. And in heaven there is God and his wonderful creatures, and he invites us to be citizens of that. That's where you begin. You have to, in other words, you have to begin by preaching the gospel of the kingdom of God to them. So most people in that category, I find, don't have any hope. And they don't have any hope because they don't see the larger scene. And that bottles them into this thing which they hate. They can't see any service, any point for. And sometimes it's because they themselves, having no hope, can't find the strength to do their job as a servant. So then they can only see their job as an attempt to manipulate and master and get ahead and control for themselves. And they instinctively feel that that isn't justifiable. And others who have heard the gospel of the kingdom, then you need to be able to talk with them about the specific good that is realized by this work. And sometimes there is something there and they themselves cannot see it. We are terribly blinded by this, you know, this prejudice about what work is good and what work isn't good. It's a terrible kind of thing. And it condemns so many people to useless agony over what they regard to be the kind of waste of time which they have to do in order to make a living. They think. Sometimes we need to say to the person, you don't have to do this to make a living. You can change jobs. God will support you. God will uphold you. But you have to have the courage to change. Sometimes that's the route we need to take. Sometimes we may need to say to them, I will help you.
Value. Just the fact that it's a job, by the nature of the case, gives it value because somebody's paying you to do something. It's worth something to somebody. Also, it gives you the money, even if it was like neutral. You have the money.
That's
and
right.
What you do with the money?
No, I agree.
Is something that brings value. So.
No, I quite agree. And there are many people, for example, especially people who have really come from places where times are hard, who are abundantly thankful to do something that is just work, because they find the value of supporting their family sufficient to give them all the joy they need out of the job. But many times, those of us who haven't really come from hard times, but have been raised in this country, we can't be satisfied with that. I had a hard time learning that lesson because I happened to be from a background where any job that was decent was good. So I don't think I've ever been a day in my life without a job. Because when I left my home country, when I went to wherever I was, I went to where there were jobs and I took whatever was there. And I don't think I've ever had a day without a job. But then I got to talking to people here, and I One reason why I use the example of car wash is because I was trying to help one fellow in particular who lived in the valley some years ago. And he could work at a car wash, but he couldn't work at a car wash. It just drove him crazy. He felt so demeaned by that job. And it took me a while to understand that this man felt entirely differently about it than I would. So I think your point is very well taken. As long at least as the job is not something evil, the mere fact that it is gainful employment and someone thinks it's worth doing is good enough, if you can receive that, if you can receive it. But we tend to have our sense of worth so undermined that many of us cannot receive it. And we say, oh, I can't work just for money. Of course, that's always false, because if it were $1 million they were working for, they would manage to do it. Yeah.
Dallas, you asked us to consider the question, what is our work?
Yes.
I'd like to ask you to tell us what your work is.
My primary work in life has to do with people. It is teaching and directing people. And it has to do in part with academic matters, but also with religious matters and just personal matters. That's what I do. Now, my job is a good part of that. And I didn't choose it, and I certainly, if it worked out well, it wasn't because I was smart, because I didn't decide to become a university professor or a writer. It's just something that came up. My goal always has been to teach and to preach the truth. It's been that since I was a teenager. And I went through college and found myself teaching high school and being an assistant minister in a church, and became so impressed with how little I knew that I decided to go back to graduate school. I didn't intend to take a degree. I fully intended to just return to the ministry when I found out a little bit more and had a little of my ignorance removed. But as it turned out, I continued to minister as well as to study. And as it turned out, it seemed to me after a while that it was a better way to go to stay in the academic world. And so I'm there for the time being. I don't know how long I'll be there.
It seems that your definition there...
But I do a lot of other things as well, you know.
But I guess I'm confused with trying to put some handles around it. Your definition there is kind of one thing, right? But it seemed in the other discussion that you call it multifaceted.
It will be multifaceted. And I think when you say, what is your work? See, there are two points of view from which you answer that. One of the points of view you answer is from, now you're looking to the future. And I say, what is my work? And then I answer it in that way. I understand that there are other things I have to take care of. But I answer it in that way because that's what I'm basically planning around. My children are grown. My wife and I, we have to work on our relationship and make sure that it stays proper and healthy and growing as we go along. But basically, at this point in my life, looking towards the future is what I'm saying. Now, the other point of view is when it's all over. And there, as I say, there my work turns out to be what I have accomplished in the way of enduring value.
The way of what?
Of enduring value. But that's the point at which now I look back, and I'm not having to plan about that. That's what turned out. So there are two different points of view. And when I suggested that you try to think into what is your work, I'm asking from this point of view where you're looking to the future. And I'm asking you to say, what is it you're really about? Now, if it is just raising your children are in trouble. And let me say something that may be shocking to you, but I think it's true. There is an important sense in which for a man especially, your work is more important than your family. Not that you should sacrifice your family to your work, but that about the only way you can give what you want to give to your family is by having a work, so that they will understand what it is for them to live and to have a work. It's very hard on children to have aimless parents or parents who are aimed wrongly. They very badly need to have parents who have a healthy sense of wholeness about their work and who are progressing in that work. You see, you have a lot of people who kind of want to make their family their work. And families aren't for that purpose. They're a part of our work, but they're not our work. And that's where we have a hard time turning our children loose, is when we're looking at our children as our work. Now, they are one of the primary reservoirs of enduring values that we can accomplish. But we have to have something much bigger and different than that as our work. Now, for women sometimes in the past, they have been totally able to look at their children as their work. It's very rare that you ever find men being able to do that, and certainly I think not today. Now, that's nothing wrong with being, you know, the male housewife. That's all right. If that's an understood role, that can be okay. But basically, you don't... The only context I hear men speaking of their family as their work is where things are really not going well. And they are falling back as the primary focus of their energies.
So we need families to sustain us in our main work.
We need them for many reasons, and they need us. That's right. We certainly do. And we need for them to understand what our work is. One of the primary problems between children and parents is when the children, especially the male children, cannot understand what their parents do. And that's very common in our society. It was not so common in earlier societies because the child observed what the parent did. But there are many, many young kids actually think that daddy goes off to the office and makes money. They do. I've actually heard young kids comment on this. You know, very young. They don't understand. My son, once when he was 3 or 4 years old, said to me one day, "Daddy, I want to go to Grow Up." Grow Up. Because we had been talking about him going to Grow Up. And he thought that was a place. Right? And we say, "Well, Daddy goes off the office and makes money." Well, what's a kid to think? But as they grow up, they don't have a sense of money. They don't have a sense of how things work. It's extremely hard. Well, Lord knows some of us don't understand what we do. So how could the kid possibly understand what we do? So it's really a very great challenge to communicate to the child what we do and why we do it. And, of course, that's why another reason, I think, Jerry, why it is so important for us to know in our own hearts that our work is not just our job, that our job is a part of our work, possibly should be something that contributes to our work, but it's not our work. Our work is a sort of totality that we are realizing through the expending of our energy. It involves our family, it involves our house, if we have one or if we're going to have one. It involves our possessions. It involves our relationships to other people in the community. And that's our work. That's who we are. That's what we do. And we need to be able to communicate that to children. Children today in our society are put under terrible pressure to make decisions about their job line, their profession, very early. And they're undermined in their confidence about their worth by a constant emphasis on this. And they don't grow up knowing how to think of their work in the other way. I'm not surprised that so many of them commit suicide now. We don't present a meaningful human context to them. They cannot see it. They don't understand why we're doing what we're doing. And that's largely because we don't.
In a way, this whole session has been an answer to my question, but specifically, I can imagine someone looking at my life, you know, as I approach this more and more and saying, you're still, you know, that you're spending your time on your career and your family and your kids and your home, and that's selfishness because those are all things that benefit you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's the response to that? You know, specifically, you really didn't mention very much about giving your time to the church work or other volunteer activities or your money to those things either.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to talk kind of about that oversight.
I don't think those are the primary problems, really. I think that, well, first of all, I shudder at the thought that anyone would make their church their work. Certainly, I've mentioned that Jesus calls us to be servants and that we are to serve others, and that, for example, washing the car, this is primarily the production of a value which is of use to other people. Our whole attitude should be that of a servant. But on the other hand, we need to have a healthy sense that that is the only way that we can save ourselves. Jesus himself said, if you try to save your life, you lose it. If you give your life, you will save it. It is a way of saving your life. And if that is selfish, then we accept that as selfishness. You see, I do want to just comment on another aspect of this, because to not plan is not necessarily to be not selfish. And I think I understand what you're sensing. And one can certainly be quite preenish and priggish about my career and all that sort of thing. You know. My career. Well, that's why I suggest it might be better called a careen, because that's what most people call their career, is a careen. They just land in one thing after another. And you know my Pete Seeger story about the two maggots on the fork. The workman picks up the fork and goes out to work, and two maggots are on it. One falls off in a crack on the sidewalk, and the other falls into a dead cat. And after 3 days, the one that fell into the crack, starved to death and practically vanished, crawls over the edge, finally gets out and meets the one who fell into the dead cat and says, what do you attribute your success in life to? And the fat maggot replies, brains and personality. Brains and personality. Well, that's a careen. Right? And anyone who says, you know, I'm successful because I'm so smart and all of that, they haven't the foggiest idea of what they're talking about. As the scripture says, promotion does not come from the east or from the west, it comes from the Lord. The Lord is the one who sets up and casts down. He disposes. And so people who think in those terms just have a mistaken view of the matter. But it is possible to be self-obsessed and self-concerned and self-confident and all of that. See, we have this funny thing in dealing with this issue that you cannot neglect the self. You have to take steps about the self. Even choosing to die to self is a choice which the self makes. And so you are presented with this curious perspective of dying to self for selfish reasons, right? And that's one of those cases where we just have to make out of it in practice what is right and not worry too much about the contradictions that can be generated verbally. And we simply know that we must do something about ourselves. We cannot drift. And if I am right, my suggestion is that the reason why we don't plan, the reason why we don't set goals, is because of our lack of confidence. And actually, that's a reproach to God, which the man with the one talent found out about. See, the man with the one talent, he didn't plan. He didn't invest. He didn't do anything. He just said, I know what God is like. He's going to come back and he's going to want his own. Boy, I'm going to hide this thing in a napkin and give it to him when he comes back. The fellow who came back did not exactly take that as a compliment. We are to launch ourselves out. We are to take measures. We are to take steps. Always trusting in God. Always intending to serve others. That is our life. It's a real concern, and I think it's one which the individual has to sort of pick one's way through as if it were a spiritual minefield and find your way, and one has to be guided by God and helped by God in those matters. It's a very important point. This gentleman back here.
Yeah, I had a question. About the fact that there are always enough time to do things that we should do.
Yes.
So when I hear that, I think it's a lot of things I should be doing. I hear, you know, messages I'm supposed to do. I just, you also mentioned how that cycle of verse, that way too. And, how does a person discern the things they should be doing?
Well, this is where you have to go back to this very careful, methodical way of looking at it. And if I were really troubled about that sort of thing now, and I occasionally find myself having to make decisions like that, and I have to put the things down that are hanging over me and calling for my attention and decide which ones I say no to. And that is what confidence in our worth before God enables us to do. Because that enables us to escape guilt motivation. And if I had one thing to say to the person who is troubled with time, I would say, stop acting out of guilt. Stop acting out of guilt. If guilt addresses you, just say, forget it. Do not act out of guilt. Act out of positive good to be realized. Guilt drives one to hopelessness and symbolic actions which are not effective. So that's, I would say, don't act out of guilt. I might counsel such a person to take the cold turkey route, put themselves in a circumstance where they can't do anything for a week, and endure the withdrawal pangs. And observe at the end of the week that the sun still comes up. We're still breathing. Your relatives will be a little shook up, probably. But it'll be reassuring them to perhaps also see that the sun still comes up, that sort of thing. So, no, I think you really have to take a stern line with them. Get off of guilt motivation. Set down the goals which are you really want to accomplish. And resolutely say no to the rest of them. And that takes some doing. It takes some real prayer. It's almost like dealing with a sickness. You have to concentrate on it. You have to, in the name of Jesus, command it. You have to deal with your feelings. One of the most important things we have to learn to do as Christians is to conquer our feelings through prayer. Not just guilt feelings, but all kinds of other feelings. Lust, anxiety, even pain. We have to learn how by prayer to make them go away. You can do that. And oh my, if we don't do something with all these feelings that are heaped upon us, we just have to recognize. In some cases, we have to recognize that we are being preyed upon. That we may have predatory relatives that are living off of us. Not necessarily in money, but in some sort of psychological satisfaction. I have to counsel parents to stop living off their children. I have people who are just being driven crazy by their adult kids. Well, you see, they just need to withdraw. There's a case where you just need to get out of their lives and let them get out of your life. And so, it depends on what's driving the particular person. But the general advice is just through prayer or fasting or whatever is needed, get rid of guilt motivation. Take a stand. I no longer do anything because I will feel guilty if I don't. Just That's tough. Because, you know, it becomes, what if I am guilty? Well, what if I am guilty? I'm not going to do it because I feel guilty. I will not be the puppet of my feelings. And so it'll take some days, maybe weeks, but you can do this by simply persisting and planning, sorting out, saying no to things. Sometimes we, in order to say no to things, sometimes we have to do a little something to straighten it up so then we can say no to it. Get the things out of your life that are hounding. And it takes a lot of courage, and we have to fall back upon. I sometimes quote to myself Milton's line from on the sonnet On His Blindness, where he says, God doth not exact day labor light denied. In other words, if you are blind, God doesn't expect you to accomplish what you would if you could see. God doth not exact day labor light denied. God gives us enough time to do what we really have to do. So it's a tough regimen, and we have to really go at it like beating a forest fire for a while. But it can be done. It can be done. And you need your friends around you to help you with it. It's kind of like needing some real support sometimes. You need a friend that you can go to and maybe say, I'm just defeated by this. Won't you let me talk to you about it? Listen to me. Say what you think. Let's pray about it. Friends can help with that. Ben.
I wanted to bring up what you were saying. I think that the question of being, is it selfish for me to think about my kids, my family, my work, because they benefit me? I think part of it's just a matter of perspective, because realistically, if you raise good kids, it may be nice at home. Chances are, raising good kids will cause more turmoil at home than not raising good kids. But because it's a big fight to raise good kids. But still, you're producing something that's going to, you know, allow you to extend your influence for good in the world further than you could get without the kids. It's a matter of perspective. Even if, say, you have a good relationship with your wife, well, that might enable her to go out into the world and influence her world in some good way instead of, you know, feeling the way she might feel if you didn't have a good relationship with her. So I think it's a matter of perspective. And also, I've always felt that doing something directly with the church did, maybe not, you know, volunteering at a hospital or something. I guess different folks have different folks, but I've always felt that doing something that I could call, quote, ministry made me feel like that I was doing something more worthwhile. So I, you know what I'm saying? I think that there is something more you said about that.
It's a very important concern, and it has to be dealt with. And there are many, many things can be said about it. One is that the most important thing you can do for your church is live your life fully and successfully in the power of God. Another thing that needs to be said is, I mean, in virtue of some things you have to take care of. I mean, it's not selfish of you to brush your teeth instead of Tom's. Why? Because they're your teeth. Right? I mean, you take care of you. And this seems like a trivial thing, but it applies to a large range of activities. You take care of you because you're you. That's not selfish. Selfishness comes in when I begin. You have to deal with selfishness carefully. Make sure you spell it out. What is selfishness? Selfishness is when I begin to hog things, as we say. When I begin to root people out of the way to get what I want. When having my way is the important thing. When I exalt myself over others and so on. That's selfishness. Selfishness is not brushing my teeth. You know, it's not taking care of me. It's not taking care of my children. That isn't selfishness. Selfishness involves these other elements. One has to be careful about that. Some others we're going to talk.
Yeah, I had a question. It doesn't relate with what we're talking about now, but Larry said everything was fair if it was brought up in the discussion beforehand.
Well,
when you started off this morning, you talked about lack of confidence and the fact that organization is a lack of organization is also
it's a sign of lack of confidence.
Then you mentioned about lack of confidence in prayer,
mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could elaborate on that a little more because I'm wondering if a lack of confidence in prayer if one is trying to establish a routine of prayer life is, and one still experiences lack of confidence in prayer, is it because they aren't persistent enough, or is it because there's no sense of change?
In short, it will be because they haven't had a successful experience in prayer. What gives you confidence in prayer is successful experience in prayer. That means primarily knowing, having the experience of praying and receiving an answer. And the more of this that is done, the more confident you will be in prayer. Now, we learn things like, if you want to have your prayers answered, you better have something definite in mind. That's where planning comes in. What do you want? Lord, bless me. Well, you know, blah. And you're not a baby lying in a cradle saying, take care of me, mommy. You know, you are a grown person. You're an adult now. You're called to be an adult, mature member of the kingdom of heaven. That means you say what you want. So when old Joash just whacks it 3 times, he bears the consequence of his deeds. Now, we are to get up, we are to focus our energies, we are to plan, we are to pray along that line, we are to learn the continuum between prayer and commanding. And that's where our confidence comes. Now, to begin with, our confidence is based simply upon the fact of Jesus' entrance into the world, his life and his death for us, his resurrection. That's the beginning confidence. That's where we really begin. But we don't stay there. That's why we go on in maturity. We grow in grace. And a major part of that growing in grace is the experience of successful praying. That's why it's so important, you see, for us to hear the word of the kingdom, for us to make plans, for us to pray in relationship to those plans. God does very little for most people because they ask him for very little. And they ask him for very little because they're not in business with him. When you go in business with God, you will never lack for anything to talk to him about. And the reason why people can't find, I have many folks who come to me and say, I just can't, how can you pray for 15 minutes? Well, I rarely ever say to them, because it's too hard on them. You know, I rarely ever say to them, well, look, go into business with God. And 15 minutes will not get you started. But that's what has to be said. You know, what are you and God doing together that you want to talk to him about? So that's the kind of thing, Jay, where we grow and we see, we finally decide that we can pray to him about what we're doing, that we can make him a partner in whether our tires get us to work, whether the committee meeting that is coming up goes in a certain way and all of that. Then we never run out of anything to talk to God about. And believe me, when we get focused, we will see the answers. They will come.
Connected with the question back here a few minutes ago, it sounds like prayer is a grand way for us to develop a God-driven time management system.
Indeed it is, Jerry. It really is. If we are lively in prayer, we will receive guidance. We will receive confidence to drop off the things that don't matter. That's the way to do it. That's the way to do it. And of course, it will be something done in cooperation with God. So it won't just be our little project. Did that do you any good? I mean, when I respond, stay after me if I don't help at all. Tom?
You challenged us to list our goals.
Yes. First in the spiritual realm, then second.
Ought to be this. The second thing is, I'd like you to challenge us to dream big in regard to goals.
Well, with regard to the latter, I had hoped I had sort of wound up on that in the last session and talking about it. I really don't know how to do much more on that, Tom, except, you know, just to say once again, look, we're citizens of the kingdom of heaven. We're the children of God. We mustn't sell ourselves short. We mustn't take all of the discouragement that comes to us and says, well, who are you, really? I mean, why do you matter? Much less get lost who needs you, that sort of thing. I don't know quite what else to say except that.
Well, maybe give us some examples of what a big goal would be.
Well, for example, what is you work with computers, right? You're in sales now, okay? One problem with dealing with this is you can't really talk in generalities. You would have to let me try to do it this way. Take your situation as being in sales with IBM. Ask yourself now, what would be the good things that could come out of your activity? What would be the good things that could come out of it? And then what would be the good way for it to come out of it? Your coworkers and all of that sort of thing. Do you believe IBM is a good company?
Yes.
You're confident that it serves and serves well in things which God would approve of?
In general.
No, okay, that's all right. That's all right. Now, what you would need to do is to think in terms of the good that is served by your company. Now, of course, we're here talking about the job part of our work. And then fill out the details of what that would mean. Jay is working more in a family business, I believe, a manufacturing business. So he would do the same thing there. Gary Weiner here is working in intellectual material as well as contracting. And so he needs to think in terms of what good can come from his work as a thinker and a writer. Larry over here has his concerns. Jerry has his. Steve here is working as a counselor and as also a researcher, thinker, writer. So see, in each case, what you do is you think of the good to be accomplished, and then you think, what good could be accomplished if God were in this and not just me? And you make your plans for the goods to be realized in terms of the cooperation between you and God.
Don't we all start out with the same kind of common goal, no matter what our job is or employment? Since we are citizens of heaven, we should be doing what focuses those we come in contact with on the King.
Well, that would be one part. No, I think that would be one part, Jerry, but I really do believe that beyond that, we need to focus on the specific thing we are doing.
I know, but by what we are doing, isn't that what's to be accomplished?
I don't think so. I think that's one thing that's to be accomplished. But I think that, for example, if I am washing cars or whatever, my primary goal has to be to do that well, and not to do it well so people will get saved or be impressed with God, but to do that well. That is the primary task. I often have people come to me and they will say, oh, isn't it wonderful that you're in the university and you can testify to the Lord? Well, it is, and I don't mean to disagree with that, but that's not my job in the university to testify to the Lord. That's really what they mean. But you see, if we aren't careful, we come back here, there's just one value, and that is testifying to the Lord. And that is not the only value. I mean, we have to look at the goods to be realized. And if we do that well, then we're in a position, of course, and we will testify to the Lord. But we will let our light shine. You see, how's that verse read? Let your light
shine
before men that they might see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. Now, if they see your good works, they will glorify your Father which is in heaven. You don't have to make sure that they do that. You do the good works.
Yeah, no, I wasn't saying that they have to see it, but that they may see it.
Indeed, I think they will. But they will see it as they enjoy the fruits of our labors. And that is, I think, a really fundamental thing for us to understand. Our primary witness is to do good. And then we should, as a part of our work, we should be involved in a group in which the kingdom of God is being preached. And we should be involved in that preaching and teaching. So that's an important part of our work too, though it's not a part of our job. And then we should be alert where it is appropriate to speak specifically to people and testify to them. But our primary and fundamental work is to do the good that comes to our hand. As Ecclesiastes tells us, whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with all thy might. And the bane and curse of this earth at the first level is that people do not do that. If people did that, we wouldn't have had that rocket shuttle thing smash. I mean, just name it. It wouldn't be the bad would be going out of it. Our primary task is to do what comes into our hand with all our might, to do it right, to do it well, to make it as God would make it if He were doing it. And I'm telling you, this world would not be recognizable if we simply did that. It would not be recognizable. So, I mean, there are many goods now that come out of that. But where our focus is on doing that job as it ought to be done. And doing it by the power of God. At least that's my view. Yes, way back there.
You mentioned about financial planning earlier.
Yes.
And several years ago, I was introduced to a financial planner and got really excited about it. Started on trying to make plans and set goals financially. And I felt like I needed some justification in my own mind to relate it to the Lord and not to be corrupt with it, to do it for selfish motives. And that's been a real struggle. And I think that sometimes I felt like I'm really losing that with just seeing how you can gain financially and then you just want to hoard it. And I guess what I'd like to hear you address is that I don't want to come up with a solution of just saying, forget it, I can't handle it, and walk away.
I hope you won't.
But I need to come to the point where because I think it's really needed in the church. I think I have a lot
badly
of
clients
that are very ignorant.
Badly needed.
Very
see, one of my main complaints about how the way money is taught in the church is it's only taught in relationship to giving. It really is. You hear a lot of people talking about prosperity in one way or another today, but that's nearly always dealt with in the process of saying, if you will give us a certain amount of money, such and such. And we really need good teaching on how to utilize our means for the glory of God. That's the purpose of it. That's the way it ought to be. And in that, of course, we have to have good teaching continuously about what we should be loving. Now, if in the ministry that we have, Jesus Christ is being set forth clearly before us, we're going to find it very easy not to prefer gold over Him. If Christ and His kingdom, if the richness of a life in the kingdom of God is not being abundantly set before us, then we're going to have troubles. But the way out of this is not to simply say, get rid of them, money is bad, possessions are bad, but rather to exalt Christ so that they will be constantly seen in relationship to Him. That's the general way you have to think about it. And for example, I would say to the individual, in times of struggle, and I have to deal with this in my own heart, because if you do have possessions or money, you have to take care of it. And that tends to make you think about it. Right? So then the answer to that is a rich devotional life that keeps you in the Scriptures and in writers which help you constantly have the right perspective on those things. And you need to be able to come up from your knees every morning feeling very happy if it were all gone. And if you do that, you're quite safe. And you can only do that as you keep remembering that Christ is the true riches, the kingdom of heaven is the reality, and that these other things are of value only in relationship to those. David Livingston gave those wonderful words, I value nothing I have except in relationship to the kingdom of God. And he had it exactly right. And see, what we need is people who can control and direct the riches of this world and be free from them. And the person is free from them who is prepared to see them all take wings like a bird and disappear. I'm just as happy today as I was the day before. That's the test. And it's a challenge, but you see, you've accepted the challenge. And what I say to you is, carry on with it. You'll learn as you go. If you take the other way out, well, there are a couple of them. One way out is just to say, all this stuff is so nasty, I don't even think about it. And many people really feel that way. And then, of course, they complain to God when things don't go well. There's no point in that. And then, of course, the other way is to just try to get rid of them all. Just say the only thing you do with riches is get rid of them. And if you take those routes, then you never have the chance to grow in your understanding. So hang in there. And if you were to find in the end that you could not be possibly happy if your riches were lost, then you might be justified in getting rid of them. But I believe you will find a way to be happy and manage them and be free of them. Well, it's almost 12 o'clock. Shall we resign for the day?
There are no more questions.
All right. I hope you'll have a fruitful afternoon, a time to think, and, of course, rest and play as well. But I do hope you'll be emboldened to write down your answers to some of these questions that I've been raising and to really face the issue of planning. There are much for all of us to learn. And if we'll just be specific and ask God to teach us, I'm sure the instruction will be there. So I'll see you this evening, if not before. Larry.
I would just say that one of the probably most helpful things is to sit down sometime and actually try to do it in terms of writing some concrete things down. And just the process itself might bring questions to your mind that we can discuss later. Because when it gets down to, of course, a lot of the questions come in working it out. But even in the trying to write it down can be quite educational.
Indeed it can, and if you have people here that you trust enough to share them with, that would be a wonderful thing too, I'm sure. Say, ask them to look at them and say, what's your honest opinion? What's your response to this?